Welcome to Democratically 2020, the podcast all about the politics, policies, and personalities of the 2020 US election. I'm your host, Karen Robinson.
So I am absolutely delighted to welcome onto the podcast this week, Latasha Brown. Latasha is an award-winning organizer. She's a philanthropist, a political consultant, jazz singer, I have to say. We have to talk about that a little bit more in a bit, Latasha. And crucially, she's the founder of Black Voters Matter, which is a power-building civic engagement organization that's been operating for a number of years, and in fact had a really important role to play in the 2017 Alabama Senate race, which we've talked about a lot on this podcast, and of course is hoping to have a huge role to play in this election. Latasha, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here today.
Well, it's a delight to speak to you, although these are less than delightful times some days.
It is, you know, we're in an interesting moment in our political history. You know, on one hand, it is a really difficult time, but on the other hand, there's a lot of possibilities, I think. Because on some level, if we're really honest about it, you know, our comfort, we became very comfortable with systems and ways of being that simply weren't right. You know, it was just below the surface. So I think that we're in a space right now that everything has kind of been bust wide open. And we've got to deal with the fragility of democracy. We've got to deal with what is happening in terms of leadership. We got a reckoning of ourselves. I think there's some people who are literally just meeting their families that live in the same house with them for the first time now. So I think we're in this moment of reckoning that is hard and can be painful, but in the end, I think it is actually opening up a space for many, many possibilities for us.
I think that's true. I think there is, when we get out the other side of this, we might be able to look back and see that that was the moment when a lot of things changed. But let's get there.
We've got to get there. But I mean, even now, I think on some level, there's a, it's just change. Change is never comfortable. Who likes change? I mean, I'm a change maker. My whole life is dedicated to being a change maker, right? But when I go to the grocery store, and I went to my grocery store and they reorganized the grocery store where the spice aisle was shifted.
Oh no.
I almost freaked out. I'm like, where are my spices? So here I am, someone who's dedicated my life to change and pushing for political and social change. But on a practical level, change is difficult. Particularly even when they move your spices. I'm telling you, I almost had a meltdown because I couldn't find my spices. And so I just say that because I think there's a part of us that is resistant to change. And there's a part of us that really wants it. And I think it's really around, it's in that sweet spot. It's in that balance. But I think change is always difficult. But change is inevitable. So the question is, how do we respond to it? You know, and how do we take advantage of the gift that change offers us?
I think that is a great place to enter into the first thing I wanted to talk to you about today, which is, before we say anything else, I want to talk to you a lot more about Black Voters Matter as an organization. But this is the week that we honored the life and mourned the passing of the great John Lewis leaders in the civil rights movement. And I was curious to know your take on that, because these were great men who perhaps were, young activists, similar to the young activists that we're seeing on the street today, speaking up at great kind of personal threat at a time, the last time perhaps America was really engaged in that struggle with change in a really epic way. I'm curious kind of what reflections you have on the passing of these men and what lessons they might have for especially those young people who are out there on the street today trying to make their own kind of trouble.
So, both of them I knew. I knew John Lewis. Matter of fact, at one point he was, I lived in his district. He was my representative. But being a native of Selma, and he would come to Selma every year for the commemoration of the Selma to Montgomery March and Bloody Sunday, which people know which is the infamous event which he was beaten on the head on the bridge. But I was actually particularly close to Reverend C.T. Vivian, who was like the strategic organizer in the civil rights movement, and spent a lot of time with him learning and listening and, you know, hearing the stories of what happened in the movement. And I think what we can gather from them, I mean, I think there's a couple of things. If I were to kind of say the three things that I get from them, one is that they all deeply were aligned, their actions and their beliefs were aligned. Mm. And I say that because, you know, even if I think about America, we always talk about the founders of this quote, great democracy, but the truth of the matter is the founders of America didn't really believe in of democracy. They did not believe that all people should participate in the process. They had ideas about it, and they created some frameworks around it, and they actually had discussions and debates. But the bottom line is they couldn't even see me as a human being, as a Black woman, and millions of others. And so, and they couldn't even see democracy for white men who didn't own land, and certainly not women. The bottom line is what they were the founders of America as a nation, and they had this ideas and set some frameworks for democracy. But people like C.T. Vivian and John Lewis, they made democracy be real. They pushed up against, is this thing called democracy really real? And so part of, and how to make it be real. And so I say that because these were people who fundamentally, everything in their life, their entire body of work from the time that, not just that they were young people, right, all the way up to their death, is that they lived a life that reflected the values that they fought for. I think that that's a major distinction. We oftentimes don't see that in our political leaders. Oftentimes we hear them say one thing because that's the thing, you know, that's the buzzword of the day. But when you look at their actions, do you really believe in democracy? Do you really believe in the health and well-being of others? And so I think that's one thing we can gather from their legacy. And I think young people, but I think all of us, around really where there is alignment in our values and in the way that we walk, live our lives. The second thing that I get from them is too that these were deeply, deeply spiritual men, and they were men of faith. And they actually believed that they had a moral high ground, that they fundamentally believed that the work that they were doing was part of a greater work. It wasn't, oftentimes I get frustrated when I hear people reduce their work like that. They did all of this work their whole lives just to get the right to vote. That is not what happened. They did all of this work, and getting the right to vote was one means to an end, but they were fighting for the recognition and reclamation of their humanity. Mm-hmm. What they were fighting for was based on that Black people, to affirm that Black people were human beings and we were citizens and contributors to this country. And it was in our right to be able to participate in a process that would make decisions about our day-to-day lives. And so what they literally were standing in a space of is a space of claiming and their humanity, and demanded that others recognize it and respect that. That's the second piece. And then the third piece, I'll just say real quickly, is, you know, is love. Mm-hmm. As simple as it sounds, there's not a single person that you will talk to that has had a conversation or any substantial engagement with either Dr. C.T. Vivian or John Lewis, and the core of whatever their speech was, whatever work, was this belief and this principle that love would be transformative, that love opposed to war, that love gave the space for people to really go in a space of repentance, to redemption, to transformation, that love provided us a way to tap into our humanity that legal, like laws didn't, but that fundamentally that's what they believe. So when I think about their legacy, those are kind of the three buckets of the way I think about their legacy and their leadership.
I mean, I think that's beautiful. And I think that the concept of leading from love is so important at a time when we're so used to watching our leadership, and I'm particularly thinking of one particular leader in the White House, leading from so much anger and hate and belittlement and diminishment. But then there is also a role for anger in all of this, isn't there?
Oh, it is. But I do want to say, I don't think that, even with them, I don't think that they say that anger does not come out of love. If somebody tries to hurt somebody that you love, you get angry. Like, I don't think that those are diametrically opposed. I think that is the come from. Like, is it coming from whatever, what is coming from? There's an anger that comes out of hate that is distinctively different than an anger that comes out of love. That literally, I think anger is an emotion. I think I think hate and love are beliefs. Yeah. That's different. I don't think they're the same thing. Anger is just an emotion that comes out of a response. Yeah. So I raise that because I think as much as, you know, I would like to blame all of this on Trump, the truth of the matter is Trump is in power because there is that principle of hate that is embedded in the culture that we refuse to deal with. Racism, the foundation of racism is hate. Yeah. The foundation of homophobia. I don't care. You can put as much religious theology as you want to on it. You can disagree however much the people, you know, on it. But the truth of the matter is the core foundation belief comes out of a space of hate, right? You can actually have folks who come out of love, might have a misunderstanding or trying to work through it because it's just not in their culture, but you can tell the difference. You can tell the difference when something comes out of hate and when something comes out of love. And we've got to be honest to make those distinctions that literally we all have emotions. There's sometimes that love makes you sad, right? Sometimes love makes you happy. Sometimes love gives you joy. It gives you all of those emotions grow out of it. But the foundation, the principle is love. Right. Hate is the same thing. Sometimes there are people who are so hateful that literally they get joy out of seeing other people in pain. Mm. There are folks who are there based in hate that they actually are happy to see other people be dominated, other people be mistreated, other people be enslaved, children being put in cages. They actually feel good about that. So I'm saying that the core that we've got to think through is beyond the emotions, we got to think of what is the values and the principles. Yeah. And where the come from is, will literally tell us a lot around all the other stuff, just emotions. But I think the core fundamental problem is what do you value?
Yeah. And I think, so once we've found the right place of love to start from, I think the next thing is we need to get organized. Tell me about Black Voters Matter and how you helped create the organization, what you were doing with it, you know, and how can we help?
Okay. Well, the first thing I did right was the day I started to fight. Keep your eyes on the prize and hold on, hold on. I sing that song because that's one of the freedom songs. That was songs that my grandmother used to sing. Who wasn't a marcher in any of the movements that I know of. And those were songs that were actually the songs that kept people connected and inspired during the movement. And so even embedded in the words of that song is the first day thing that I did right was the day that I decided to fight and keep your eyes on the prize, hold on. And for me, the prize is Black liberation. For Cliff, who was my business partner and the co-founder, that is our last 25 years. He, myself, and his wife, of work has been, how can we actually create a better world and bring about liberation for the community that I come from, which I think ultimately is not just about just my community. I think that literally that when you lift up the community that has been marginalized, that you lift up the opportunity for all peoples. And so in that space, we created Black Voters Matter Fund in 2016, because what we wanted to do is to help build Black political independent power that wasn't attached to necessarily a candidate or political party. We think that's part of the problem, you know, but that people themselves, that citizens themselves had a sense of their own agency, were reminded of their power and their value of just simply being a human being. You know, when folks say that if you don't vote, you don't count, that is so disrespectful. People count and value because they are people, right? At the end of the day, them voting is actually them demonstrating and operating their agency. And so part of our organization, what we decided to do is to create an organization that would strengthen Black-led grassroots groups. And so we work in about 11 states, 15 states on a broader level, where in each of those states, we support and work with about 20 to 25 Black-led grassroots groups, because we think where real change happens is from the ground up, not the top down. We do that in a number of ways by providing resources, strategic partnership, and just building out a network and a collective vision together. We believe that if we're going to really change and create something different, then we've got to envision something different. What's been created that someone did not visualize first? Like, you know, someone has to have a vision. And so that our work isn't just about combating those ills in our communities and advocating for things that we desire, but also to create a new set of, use our imagination. I call it the radical reimagining of America, mm-hmm. that we're creating some of these systems that we know have not been fair or just and have been exclusive and have been have marginalized communities, that we will replace those systems with systems that actually give an opportunity to embrace all people, regardless of age, ideology, race, sexual orientation, but that we truly had the opportunity to create a world that said that all human life had value. And so that's what our work, in the process we do that, is we do a lot of election work. So yes, we do a lot of campaign work. We do a lot of work around elections because that's one way of being able to get policy made by putting people in office and exerting power in the political process. But that's not the only way. That's not the only way we do it, but that is a large part of our work around voting and the voting process. But like I said, the other piece is around developing and building the capacity of those groups and organizations that are literally seeking to improve the lives of that community that are working in.
Right. So it's infrastructure for the long term and then election work for the near term.
Absolutely, absolutely. And then the third thing that we do is around kind of narrative shift, that part of the reason why our name is Black Voters Matter instead of Black Votes Matter, because there are people that care about Black votes, but don't care about Black voters. Mm-hmm. And so what we, you know, we tell the stories. We use stories as an organizing tool. Some rural communities that have been isolated, we actually lift up their stories and share them around some of the progress that's being made. So because people are empowered when they feel connected, and sometimes in these communities, they feel very isolated. Yeah. And so we actually do a lot of narrative work, as well. And all of that is peppered with what we call Black love and joy. And so everything that we do, we integrate joy in it. And so that's why we sing a lot. We actually have the Blackest bus in America that we travel around that brings joy. We use a lot of music. We actually use culture from eating together to dancing to those things that affirm us in our community. We use those cultural tools to actually generate Black joy, because a lot of this work and a lot of what communities are experiencing is traumatic. Yeah. And so in the midst of trauma, we all need a little joy, don't we?
100%. I really love that, because one of the things that I think I and a lot of people feel is there's so much bad news out there, and processing it all is just a lot of work, and it's a lot of mental work and emotional work. I'm aware of an awful lot of efforts specifically directed against the African-American community to suppress the vote, to make voting more difficult. I'm aware of, you know, things happening in states like North Carolina and Georgia in the recent election, where it just feels really frustrating that you feel like voters' voices are not being heard. What is the most effective thing that we as citizens can be doing to speak up in support of our fellow citizens to make sure that, you know, we kind of push back against some of those bad news stories that are getting us down?
I think there's a couple of things. One just quick piece is we've got to hold leaders accountable, mm-hmm. that we need new leadership in this country, just across the board. And I don't think that it's just at the president, the federal level. We need new senators. We need across the board. Anybody who is standing in the way of democracy, I don't care if they're Republican or Democrat, anybody that is standing in the way of democracy, they've got to go. And so anybody who has not been speaking out around what has been happening, this major travesty of justice around voter suppression, we have to hold them accountable, and we've got to get them out of office. I mean, just point blank, that's just like a starting point. Secondly, in that process, not just in that, but I also think that we've got to talk about this more, that we talk about voter suppression like it's just isolated. Oh, that just happened. It has been ongoing. You know, it is, it's been expanding in years. We've seen ever since the 2013 Shelby versus Holder decision, where the Supreme Court basically stripped the Voting Rights Act. We've seen voter ID laws, those things that we've kind of taken as being innocent, all of those things are like a death by a thousand cuts. That if you shave off a few votes here, if you discourage a couple of people here, if you shave off a couple of here, then ultimately what you will have is you will have a mass scale voter suppression. So the other thing is people can, one, use their power to really reach out to their electors, whether you've got a good elected or not. Even if it's a good person, you should be reaching out to them and talking to them about voter suppression and ask them the hard question. What are you doing about voter suppression? Yeah. You need to be asking on the city level, on the state level, on the federal level. So that's one thing you can do. The second thing that you can do, what we talked about, is use your power as a voter to hold folks accountable in that space. The third thing that you can do is support organizations that are doing voter suppression work. Right now, what we don't see is the kind of leadership, the political leadership, to really be able to address this issue. We need more boots on the ground and more people and organizations that are doing this work. And the way that we're able to do our work is we need resources. So whether it's our organization or other organizations like Fair Fight, the New Georgia Project, ACLU or NAACP, you know, write a check. If you know you're not an activist, that's fine. But write a check to organizations that are actually standing in and protecting democracy for us. And the fourth thing is we need to talk to our families more. You know, that at the end of the day, we've become so individual in the Western world that oftentimes we're not even talking to the people that we got the most impact or had the most influence with. So we should be having these conversations at the dinner table. We should be having these conversations at the family reunions. We should be talking about the America that we want to see, and we should, and not based on something we saw on Twitter or what CNN or Fox News said, but that fundamentally, as we're actually talking about this to our neighbors and learning more. The last thing would be, like, we've really got to, you know, in some ways, this is really unfortunate, but I think in some ways we've become lazy thinkers. And what I mean by that is right now, what we really like is we really like to turn on the TV and get all of our opinions off the news. And then we go out and we spread those opinions, right? When in fact, I think that there's danger in that. I think what we need people to do is to talk more, to research more, to read more, to take time that we're actually really thinking beyond what the pundits are saying. Whether we like the pundits or not, we're thinking beyond the sound bites around, is this really true? And asking ourselves, is this really true? What is the kind of world that I want to live in, I want my children to live in? And let that be our driver and not what the next pundit has said that has a nice little ring because it's a sound bite.
Yeah. I love that. That gives me a lot of good places to start, and it's making me think I need to call my family.
Yes.
Mom and dad, they'll thank you. So we'll have that conversation. One final thing before I want to talk to you about, and then if you've got just another few minutes, I'd love to play the gut check game with you. But one final thought that I just need to throw in there. The Biden campaign has said that next week they'll probably be making their announcement about a VP selection. Vice President Biden has had a lot of pressure to choose a minority person, a minority woman, to be his running mate. I'm curious how you think about that in terms of representation versus kind of just somebody in there with the right values and who's leading from heart. How does it feel to you?
So I think that, you know, I'm one of the people who I firmly believe that he needs to pick not just a minority woman. I firmly believe he needs to pick a Black woman.
Yeah.
And I specifically, you know, there are a couple of things. So the first thing is, you know, I just want people just to think about this. So Black women have been the most consistent, loyal, percentage-wise, turnout base for the Democratic Party for the last 50 years, more than any other constituency group, right? We have never been nominated to the Supreme Court. Our name has never been nominated to the Supreme Court. We've never been put in a position of a president or vice president. Let me ask this. Where in America or in the world would white men be the most consistent base of any field for 50 years and leadership position? They would not have a consideration of the top leadership position. It just wouldn't happen. People would actually think something was wrong with the system. Like, they would actually be like, something is wrong. And so I'm raising that because we have been so taken for granted that even in our request in saying that is as if we're asking for something that we shouldn't be asking for, right? It's been 50 years. How long, y'all? And ultimately, are Black women just voting because we're voting to participate? No, this is really about why would you not think we want power like every other constituency group? But so there's one element around that, that just the fact of the matter is politically people participate and there is value in their participation that has not been honored by the Democratic Party, right? Secondly, though, right now we're in a time in this country, and I think we certainly saw this with the women's movement. We're in the 100th year of the women's suffrage movement, 55th year of the voting rights movement, that ultimately this is a moment, I think, across the board for women to rise up. Like we need, if any time we need the kinds of leadership of a woman, you know, it is now. And I think that Joe Biden recognized that because when he said, I am going to pick a woman as vice president, nobody questioned it. There was never, everybody was like, okay, yeah, that sounds about right. Cause we all know it's the time for that. Right. And so, given that, let me also go with, we're in a moment in which we saw the largest uprising of American citizens in this history of intergenerational, interracial, multi-generational, multiracial, intergenerational people rise up in all 50 states saying Black Lives Matter because we understood and understand how structural racism is destroying this country. I say that because who sits squarely at the intersection of sexism and the exclusion of women and racism and anti-Black racism like a Black woman? My point is that Black women actually have an offering that they can make, not just for this campaign, but also it does speak to the future of where America is going. And I do think that there's some brilliant Black women who should be considered, but it's our time. It is just simply a time that we need to no longer be excluded from a process that out of every constituency group in this country, we have been the most consistent.
Yeah, I can't argue with that. It's 100% true. Black women have been the heart and soul of the Democratic Party for, as you say, going on 50 years now. And also I think—
Okay, not the leadership, which is problematic.
No, the heart and soul, but not the
premier leadership. We can be the workhorses. We'll make you a chair of this or whatever. We can be the workhorses. And that's how America has treated Black women.
Yeah.
You know, we'll be the managers. We'll be the managers that we can get opportunities to work, right? Because on some level, I think America recognizes that we do have a history and a culture and an ethic of working. However, what we have not seen is we have not seen our leadership supported in the same way that we've supported others.
Brilliant. That's thank you. That's really helpful. So have you got just a few more minutes and we can quickly play the gut check game?
Okay. Yep. Cause I've got it.
You've got a lot of things going on. We'll just run through a couple of these. I've got a list here in front of me of quotes that have come up just for the past week or so, talking in various different aspects about things to do with Black voters. I'll pick this one here. This is from Representative Pramila Jayapal in the hearing of Bill Barr this week. She says to him, "You're aware of certain kinds of protesters, but in Michigan, when protesters carry guns, Confederate flags, and swastikas, and call for the governor of Michigan to be beheaded, shot, and lynched, somehow you're not aware of it. You did not send federal agents in to do to the president's supporters what you did to the president's protesters."
I mean, I think it's the writing is on the wall. I think she's very clear. The bottom line is there's this distinction between how some people are treated and how others are, that the state has actually been complicit in supporting and protecting white supremacists and has been complicit in supporting white nationalists. It has been embedded. You have the leader and the Department of Justice that are actually supporting those who are walking around with SWAT stickers. So, I mean, ultimately, we've got to really recognize around what is happening. We are in fascism. We are in pre-fascism, right? In some ways, some folks don't say it's pre. And so we've got to, it's new. It's a new paradigm shift politically. So it's hard for people just to say what it is, but let's call it what it is. My grandfather says, "Walk like a duck, talk like a duck." you know, it must be a duck. The truth of the matter of what she was raising is that there is not a necessarily the Department of Justice is being used to weaponize against citizens that don't agree with the current administration. That is the by the very definition of fascism.
Yep. I can't disagree with a word of that. I am so glad that somebody is calling him out in the House of Congress. I think it's well past time. And I'm, you know, it can't be stood for anymore. And I'm glad that somebody's using direct words, not none of this beating around the bush about, oh, it's inappropriate. I think we just need to call it out.
Yep, we just got to call it out. I am going to have to go, though, because I've got 15 minutes for something else. So if there's enough, I can answer one more question, but I do have to go.
Okay, I got one more for you. I'll go straight to the big guns then. Here's President Trump. You can argue with him. He says about Black voters, we have the best numbers for African Americans on employment and unemployment in history. Best everything.
My comment always is, are we still listening to him? What can we trust that he says? He is a habitual liar. He exaggerates. He manipulates information and manipulates numbers. Right now, we know that there's over 30 million people in this country who are out of work. We know that they're severely in our community. You can't just go by the unemployment numbers, you know, or the employment numbers, that there's a severe, there's a significant part of the population who have been underemployed. There are folks who are working 3 and 4 jobs and still can't pay their rent. So having a job is not enough. We should be talking about economic equity and parity. Are we talking about how we're dealing with housing and people's access to housing? So at the end of the day, just like all of us, we know that it's not just based on you getting a check. It's based on what kind of check you're getting, what the frequency of that check, and what is available for you to have access to. And so to actually use the employment numbers as an indicator, that's more of an indicator of the stock market. That's how they make their decisions. That's not necessarily an indicator on the health and the well-being and economic and financial security and safety of people.
I can't disagree with a word of that. Listen, Latasha Brown, it has been such a delight to talk to you today. I wish that we could talk all day, but I know you've got a million other things going on and a million other people, and go do your work. I really appreciate your time.
I appreciate you. Thank you for having me. Look forward to coming again. Talk to you soon.
Great. Take care. Bye-bye. And that's it. As always, you can reach me on Twitter. I'm at Karen Jayar on Twitter. Please, if you can, give whatever you can to the Democratically 2020 Victory Fund at secure.actblue/donate/democratically. Don't worry, you don't have to remember it. You can go to the link that's in the show notes. If you haven't yet registered to vote or requested your absentee ballot, please, please do that right now. Everyone should be aiming to vote absentee this year, and it's nice and easy to do at vote.org, or if you're an American overseas like me, votefromabroad.org. And finally, I should let you know that this podcast is not affiliated with any organization or entity. No sponsors, nobody's throwing money at me. In fact, nobody seems to ever ask me to do this except all of you wonderful listeners, and I appreciate you for it. So I hope you all have a wonderful week. I'll talk to you next week.